This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled A Child's Changing Consciousness and Waldorf Education. I believe it is also entitled in the newer edition, A Child's Changing Consciousness as a Basis for Pedagogical Practice. This is Lecture 4, given in Dornach on April 18, 1923. In our previous meetings, I have tried to lead you into what we understand here as knowledge of the human being. Some of what is still missing will surely find its way into our further considerations during this conference. I have also told you that this knowledge of the human being is not of a kind that will lead to theories, but one that can become human instinct, ensouled and spiritual instinct, which, when cast into deeds, can lead to living educational principles and practice. Of course, you must realize that in giving lectures of this kind, it is only possible to point the way, in the form of suggestions, to what such knowledge of the human being can do for the furtherance of practical teaching. But just because our main aim is one of practical application, I can give only broad outlines, something which is very unpopular these days. Few people are sufficiently aware that anything expressed in words can, at best, be only a hint, a mere indication of what in actual life is far more complex and multifarious. If we bear in mind that the young child is essentially an ensouled sense organ, entirely given over in a bodily, religious way to what comes toward it from the surrounding world, we shall take care that, up to the change of teeth, everything within its vicinity is suitable to be received through the child's senses, thereafter to be inwardly worked upon. Above all, we have to be aware that whenever the child perceives with its senses, at the same time, through its soul and spirit, it also absorbs the inherent moral element of what is perceived. This means that at the approach of the change of teeth, we have already set the scene for the most important impulses of its later life, and that when it enters school, we are no longer faced with a blank page, but with one already full of content. And now that we are moving more toward the practical aspects of education, we have to take into account that between the change of teeth and puberty, nothing entirely original can be initiated in the child, but that it is the teacher's task to recognize the impulses that have already been implanted during the first 7 years. These they have to direct toward what is likely to be demanded of the pupils in their later lives. This is why it is of such importance for teachers to be capable of perceiving what is stirring within their pupils. For there is more than meets the eye in these life stirrings at the time when the child enters school. Teachers must not simply decide what they are going to do or which method is right or wrong. It is far more important for them to recognize what is inwardly stirring and moving in these children, to guide and develop it further. Naturally, this is bound to raise a question that we have so far been unable to answer in the Waldorf school in practical terms by opening a kindergarten. The work entailed in bringing up and educating children from birth to the second dentition is certainly of paramount importance. But since in the Waldorf school we are already facing great difficulties in coping with the demands involved in teaching children of official school age, we cannot possibly think of opening a kindergarten, because every year we also have to open a new class for our oldest pupils. So far, we have started with an 8-year course in the Waldorf school. At present, we could not possibly entertain the idea of also opening a kindergarten or something similar as a preparatory step for our class 1. People who take a somewhat light-hearted view of these things may be of the opinion that all that is needed is to make a beginning with a nursery or kindergarten, and that the rest will surely follow. But things are not as simple as that. What is needed is a fully comprehensive yet detailed program, covering both pedagogical and practical aspects of teaching in a nursery class. To devote oneself to such a task is impossible, as long as a new class has to be added every year. The seriousness and responsibility involved in the so-called movements for school reform is recognized by far too few people. To unprofessional, though well-meaning persons, it seems enough to voice one's demands, demands easy enough to make. In our day, when everybody is so clever, I am not being sarcastic, I am quite serious, nothing is easier than to formulate demands. All that is needed in our society, which is simply bursting with cleverness, is for 11 to 12 people, even 3 or 4 would be brainy enough, to come together to work out a faultless program for school reform, listing their requirements in order of priority. I have no doubt that their theoretical demands would be highly impressive. Such programs, compiled in the abstract, in so many places today, are most cleverly conceived. Because people have become so intellectual, they excel in achievements of an external and abstract kind. But if one judges these matters out of real life experience, and not intellectually, the situation is not unlike one where a number of people have come together to discuss and decide what the performance of an efficient stove should be. Obviously, they would come up with a whole list of, quote, categorical imperatives, close quote, such as that the stove must be capable of heating the room adequately, it must not emit smoke, and so on. But, though the various points may be convincing enough, knowledge of them alone would hardly result in the necessary know-how to light it, keep it going, and control its heat. To be able to do this, one has to learn other things as well. In any case, depending on the location of the room, the condition of the chimney, and possibly on other factors as well, it may not even be possible to fulfill the conditions so competently set forth. But this is how most of the programs for school reform are arrived at today, more or less in an equally abstract manner as the requirements for the hypothetical stove. This is the reason why one cannot contravene them, for they no doubt contain much that is correct. But to cope with the practical needs of an existing school is something very different from making demands which, ideally speaking, are justified. Here one does not have to deal with how things ought to be, but with a number of actual pupils. Here one has to deal, allow me to mention it, for it is all part of school life, one has to deal with a definite number of teachers of varying gifts and abilities. All this has to be reckoned with. There is no problem in planning a program for school reform in the abstract. But the concrete reality is that only a certain number of gifted teachers are available, and that it may not even be possible for them to fulfill the demands agreed upon in theory. This fundamental difference between life as it is and an intellectual approach to it is something our present society is no longer able to appreciate. Because it has become so accustomed to an intellectual interpretation of life, it can no longer perceive this quality, least of all where it is most patently present. Anyone who is aware of the great difference between theory and practice will detect the worst excesses of impractical theories in our present business life. In reality, the structure of today's business life has become as theoretical as can be. Those in control grasp power with robust hands. They use their elbows and often brutally push through their theoretical policies. This goes on until the business is ruined. In the economic sphere, it is possible to proceed intellectually. But in a situation where one meets life in the raw, such as in a school, where it is not simply a case of helping oneself, but where existing impulses have to be worked upon, in such a situation, even the most beautiful theories are of little use unless they offer the possibility of working pragmatically and out of a truly individual knowledge of what the human being is. This is the reason why teachers whose heads are full of pedagogical theories are usually least fit for practical classroom situations. More capable by far are those who still teach out of a certain instinct, teachers who out of their natural love for children are able to recognize and to meet them. But today, it is no longer possible to rely on instinct, unless it is backed by spiritual knowledge. Modern life has become too complex for such a way of life, which would be possible only under more primitive conditions, under conditions almost bordering on the level of animal life. All this has to be considered if one wishes to see in the right light what is being presented here as a really practical form of pedagogy. Generally speaking, education has followed in the footsteps of our modern civilization, which has gradually become more and more materialistic. A symptom of this is the frequent use of mechanical methods in preference to organic methods, and this just during the early years of childhood up to the change of teeth, which is the most impressionable and important time of life. We must not lose sight of the fact that up to the second dentition the child lives by imitation. The serious side of life, with all its demands in daily work, is re-enacted in deep earnestness by the child in its play, as already mentioned yesterday. The difference between a child's play and an adult's work is that an adult's contribution to society is governed by a sense of purpose and has to fit into outer demands, whereas the child wants to be active simply out of an inborn and natural impulse. Play activity streams outward from within. Adult work takes the opposite direction, namely inward from the periphery. The significant and most important task for the class teacher years consists in just this gradual progression from play to work. And if one is able to answer in practical terms the great question of how a child's play can gradually be transformed into work, one has solved the fundamental problem during those middle years from 7 to 14. In its play, the child mirrors what is happening around it. It wants to imitate. But because, through lack of knowledge of the human being, the key to childhood has been lost, all kinds of artificial play activities for children of kindergarten age have been intellectually contrived by adults. Whereas, all the child wants to do is to imitate the work of the grown-ups, special games have been invented for its benefit, such as lay the little sticks, or whatever else these things are called. These artificial activities actually deflect the child's inner forces from flowing out of its organism like a living stream, finding a natural outlet in the child's desire to imitate its elders. Through all kinds of mechanical manipulations, children are encouraged to do things that are not at all suitable for their age. During the 19th century, especially, programs for nursery education were thought out, entailing activities a child should not really perform. For the entire life in a nursery class revolves around the children adapting themselves to the few persons in charge who should conduct themselves in a natural way, so that the children feel stimulated to imitate whatever their teachers are doing. There is no need for the nursery class staff to go from one child to the next to show each one what it has to do. The child does not yet want to follow given instructions. All it wants to do is to copy what the adult is doing. And so the task of a kindergarten teacher is to adjust work taken from daily life so that it becomes suitable for the children's play activities. There is no need to think out occupations met with in adult life only under special circumstances, such as work requiring specialized skills. For example, children of nursery class age are told to make parallel cuts in strips of paper, and then to push many colored paper strips through the slits so that finally a woven colored pattern emerges. This kind of mechanical process in a kindergarten actually prevents children from engaging in normal or congenial activities. it would be better to give them some very simple sewing or embroidery to do. Whatever a young child is told to do should not be artificially contrived by adults who are comfortable in our intellectual culture, but should spring from life's ordinary tasks. The whole point of a nursery class is to give young children the opportunity to imitate life in a simple and wholesome way. This task of adjusting adult life with all its purposefulness to the level of kindergarten age, so that what is done there will satisfy the child's natural and inborn need to be active, is an immensely important pedagogical task. To think out little stick games or design paper weaving cards is simple enough, but to whittle down our complicated forms of life in the way a child does when, for example, a little boy plays with a spade or some other tool, or a girl with a doll, in the way children transform adult occupations into child's play, and to achieve this also in the case of more complicated activities in the adult world, this is the great and important task which needs to be accomplished. It is time-consuming work for which so far hardly any previous quote-unquote spade work has been done. For one needs to recognize that in children's imitation, in all their sense-directed activities, moral and spiritual forces are at work, artistic impulses which allow the child to respond in an entirely individual way. Give a child a handkerchief or a piece of cloth, knot it so that a head appears above and two legs below, and you have made a doll or a kind of a clown. With a few ink stains, you can give it eyes, nose, and mouth, or better still, you allow the child to do it. And you will see that a healthy child will have great joy with such a doll. For now it can supplement, with imaginative and imitative soul activity, many other features belonging to a doll. It is far better if you make a doll out of a linen rag than if you give the child one of those perfect dolls, possibly with highly colored cheeks, smartly dressed, a doll which will even close its eyes when put down horizontally, and so on. For what are you doing if you give the child such a doll? You prevent it from unfolding its own soul activity. Every time a fully finished object catches its eye, the child has to suppress an innate desire for soul activity, for unfolding its wonderfully delicate, awakening fantasy. You separate the child from life because you hold back its own inner activity, so much about the child up to the shedding of the milk teeth. So much about the child, up to the shedding of the milk teeth. And when the child enters school, one is quite likely to meet a certain inner opposition, mainly against reading and writing, as mentioned yesterday. Try to see the situation through a child's eyes. There stands a man. He has black or blonde hair. He has a forehead, nose, eyes. He has legs. He walks. He holds something in his hands. He says something. He has his own thought life. This is father. And now the child is to accept that this sign, F-A-T-H-E-R, represents the real father. There is not the slightest reason why it should do so. The child brings with it formative forces, eager to flow out of its organism. Previously, these forces were instrumental in bringing about the wonderful formation of the brain with its adjoining nervous system. They wrought the wonderful formation of the second teeth. One ought to become modest and ask oneself how one could possibly be capable of creating out of one's own resources such second teeth on the basis of the first milk teeth. What sublime powers of wisdom, of which we are totally unaware, are working in all these forces? The child was entirely given over to this unconscious wisdom, weaving through the formative forces. The child lives in space and time. And now, suddenly, it is to make sense of all that is imposed upon it through learning how to read and write. It is not right to lead the child directly into the final stages of our advanced culture. We must lead it in harmony with what wants to flow from its own being. The right way of introducing the child to reading and writing is to allow the formative forces, which up to its seventh year have been working upon the physical organization, and which now are being released for outer soul activities, to become actively engaged. For example, instead of presenting the child directly with letters or even complete words, you draw something looking like this, and he has a mouth, he's drawn a mouth. In this way, appealing to the formative forces in its soul, you will find that now the child can remember something that has real meaning, something it had already grasped with its formative forces. It will tell you, quote, "That is a mouth," close quote. And now you can ask it to say, quote, "mouth," close quote. Then you ask it to leave out the end part of the word, gradually getting the child to pronounce m. Next you can say, "Let us paint what you have said just now. We have left something out, therefore this is what we paint." Steiner then draws just the top part of the mouth. "And now, let us make it even simpler." And now he draws it very much like the letter M. It has become the letter M. Or we draw something looking like this. See next drawing, it's a fish, and then gradually is formed into an actual F. The child will say fish. The teacher, "Let us make it simpler, this fish." Again, one will ask the child to sound only the first letter, in this way obtaining the letter F. And so, out of the pictures, we lead to the abstract letter forms. There is no need to go back historically in order to show how our contemporary writing evolved from ancient pictography. For our pedagogical purposes, it is quite unnecessary to delve into the history of civilization. All we have to do, helped along by wings of fantasy, is to find our way into this method, and then, no matter which language we speak, to choose some characteristic words which we transform into pictures, and from which we finally derive the actual letters. In this way, we work together with what the child inwardly wants during the second dentition and immediately afterward. From this you will gather that after having introduced writing via drawing painting and painting drawing, it is good for the child to use color immediately because it lives in color, as everyone knows who deals with children, one can progress to reading. For in writing, the entire human being is active. The hand is needed, the whole body has to adapt itself, even if only to a slight degree. The entire person is involved. Writing, when evolved from painting drawing, still remains something more concrete than reading. When reading, well, one just sits. One has already become like a timid mouse, for only the head has to make an effort. Reading has already become abstract. It should be evolved by degrees as part of the whole process. But if, in order to work in harmony with human nature, one adopts this method, one can become extraordinarily difficult. No, it can become extraordinarily difficult to withstand the prejudices of our times. Naturally, the pupils will learn to read a little later than is expected of them today. And if they have to change schools, they appear less able than the pupils in their new class. Yet, is it really justified to kowtow to the views of a materialistic culture with its attendant demands of what an 8-year-old child should know? The real point is that it may not be at all beneficial for such a child to learn to read too early. For by doing so, something is being blocked for life. If a child learns to read too early, one leads it into abstractions prematurely. If reading were taught a little later, countless potential sclerotics would be able to lead happier lives. For it is possible to trace back a hardening of the entire human organism, to give it a simpler name, which manifests itself in the most diverse forms of sclerosis in later life, to a faulty method of introducing reading to a child. Of course, such symptoms can result from many other causes as well, but the point is that the effects of soul and spirit upon a person's physical constitution are hygienically enhanced if the teaching at school is attuned to human nature. If you know how to form your lessons rightly, you will at the same time give your pupils the best foundation for health. And you may be sure that if the methods of our present-day educational system were healthier, far fewer men would be walking about with bald heads. Too little attention is paid by people with a materialistic outlook to the mutual interaction between the soul and spiritual nature and the physical body. Again and again I wish to point out that the tragedy of our present materialistic attitude is that it no longer has an understanding of the material processes, which it observes only externally, and that it no longer recognizes that a moral element enters the physical. Already the way in which the human being is treated, one could almost say maltreated, by our natural science, is liable to lead to misconceptions about what a human being is. You need only think of the usual types of illustrations found in contemporary textbooks on physiology or anatomy, where you see pictures of the skeleton, the nervous system, and the blood circulation. The way these are drawn is very suggestive, implying that they are a true representation of reality, and yet they do not convey the actual facts at all, or at best only 10% of them, for 90% of the human body consists of liquid substances which are in constant flow and which consequently cannot be drawn in fixed outlines. Now you may say, quote, physiologists know that, close quote. True, but this knowledge remains within the circle of physiologists. It does not enter society as a whole, especially because of the strongly suggestive influence of these illustrations. And there is something else of which people are even less aware. Not only does solid matter constitute the smallest part of our physical body, while by far the largest part is liquid, but we are also creatures of air at every moment of our lives. At one moment the air surrounding us is inside us, and in the next the air within our body is outside us again. We are part of the air surrounding us, which is constantly fluctuating within us. And what of the conditions of warmth? In reality, we have to discriminate between our solid, liquid, aeriform, and warmth organizations. These distinctions could be further extended, but for the time being we will stop here. It will become evident that quite meaningless and erroneous ideas are held concerning these matters, if we consider the following. If these illustrations of the skeleton, the nervous system, and so on really represented the true state of affairs, always implying that the human being is a solid organism, if this were really the whole truth, then it would be little wonder if the moral element, the life of the soul, could not penetrate this solid bone matter or this apparently rigid blood circulation. The physical and moral life would have to have separate existences. But if you include the liquid, gaseous, and also the warmth organizations in your picture of the individual, then you have a fine agent, a refined entity, for example, in the varying states of warmth, for allowing the existing moral constitution to also extend into the physical processes of warmth. If your picture is based on reality, you will come to find this unity between what is physical and what is of a moral nature. It is this you have to bear in mind when working with the growing human being. It is essential to have this awareness. And so it is really important for us to look at the totality of the human being and to find our way unimpeded by generally accepted physiological, psychological attitudes. It will enable us to know how to treat the child who, otherwise, will develop inner opposition toward what it has to learn. It should be our aim to allow our young pupils to grow gradually and naturally into their subjects, and then they will also love what they have to learn. But this will happen only if their inner forces become fully involved in these new activities. The most damaging effects, just during the age of 7 to 9, are caused by one-sided illusions, by fixed ideas about how certain things ought to be taught. For example, the 19th century, but this was already prepared for in the 18th century, was tremendously proud of the new phonetic method of teaching reading, which superseded the old method of making words by adding single letters, a method which was again replaced by the whole word method. And because today people feel ashamed of openly respecting old ways, one will hardly find anyone prepared to defend the old spelling method. According to present opinion, such a person would be considered an old crank, for to enthuse over the old-fashioned spelling method is simply not done. It is the phonetic and also the whole word method that carry the day. One feels very proud of the phonetic method, teaching the child to develop a feeling for the quality of sounds. No longer do young pupils learn to identify separate letters such as P, N, or R, but they are taught to pronounce the letters as they sound in a word. There is nothing wrong in that. The whole word method is also good, which sometimes even begins by analyzing a complete sentence, from which the teacher progresses to separate words and then to single sounds. What is bad is when these things become fads. The underlying ideas of all three methods are good. There is no denying that each one has its merits. But what is it that makes them so? Imagine that you know a person only from a photograph showing a frontal view. The picture will have created in you a certain image of the person. Now imagine that another picture falls into your hands, and that someone tells you that this is the same person. A second picture shows a side view and creates such a different impression that you may feel convinced that it could not be the same person. Yet in reality both photographs depict the same individual, only from different angles. And this is how it always is in life. Everything has to be considered from different angles. It is easy to fall in love with one's own particular point of view because it appears to be so convincing. And so one might have good reasons for which to defend the spelling method, the phonetic method, or the whole word method, to an extent that anyone of the opposite opinion could not refute one's arguments. Yet even the best of reasons may prove to be only one-sided. In actual life, everything has to be considered from the most varied angles. If the letter forms have been gained through painting drawing and drawing painting, and if one has gone on to a kind of phonetic or whole word method, which is now appropriate because it leads the child to an appreciation of a wholeness and prevents it from becoming too fixed in details, if all this has been done, there is yet something else which has been overlooked in our materialistic climate. It is this: the single sound by itself, the separate M or P. This too represents a reality. And it is important to see that when a sound is part of a word, it has already entered the external world, already passed into the material and physical world. What we have in our soul are the sounds as such, and these largely depend on the nature of our soul. When we pronounce letters, such as the letter M, for example, we actually say E-M. The ancient Greek did not do this. He pronounced it mu. In other words, he pronounced the auxiliary vowel after the consonant, whereas we put it in front of the consonant. Today, in Middle Europe, we find the sound of a letter by proceeding from the vowel to the consonant. But in ancient Greece, only the reverse path was taken. This is an indication of the underlying soul condition of the people concerned. Here, we have a significant and important phenomenon. If you look at language, not merely from an external or utilitarian point of view, for today language has mainly become a means of conveying thought or messages, and words are hardly more than symbols for outer things. If you go back to the soul element living in the word, living in language as a whole, you will find the way back to the real nature of the so-called sounds. For every sound with a consonantal quality has an entirely different character from a vowel sound. As you know, there are many different theories explaining the origin of language. Quote, here we have a situation similar to that of the photographs taken from different angles. Close parenthesis. Among others, there is the so-called bow wow theory, representing the opinion that words are an imitation of sounds coming from different beings or objects. According to this theory, when people began to speak, they imitated characteristic outer sounds. For instance, they heard a dog barking, bow wow. If they wished to express a similar soul mood, they produced a similar sound. No one can refute such an idea. On the contrary, there are many valid reasons to support this Bow Wow theory. As long as one argues only from this particular premise, it is irrefutable. But life does not consist of proofs and refutations. It is full of living movement, of transformation, of living metamorphosis. What is right in one particular situation can be wrong in another, and vice versa. Life has to be comprehended in all its mobility. Now, as you may know, there is another theory, called the Ding Dong theory, whose adherents strongly oppose the Bow Wow theory. According to this second theory, the origin of language is explained in the following way. When a bell is struck, the ensuing sound is caused by the specific constitution of its metal. A similar mutual relationship between object and sound is also ascribed to human speech. The ding-dong theory represents more of feeling oneself into the materiality of things, rather than an imitation of external sounds. Again, this theory is quite correct in certain respects. Much could be said for either of these two theories. However, in reality, language came into being neither exclusively according to the ding-dong theory nor to the bow-wow theory, though both theories contain elements of truth. Many other related factors would also have to be considered, but taken in isolation, each theory gives only a one-sided point of view. There are many instances in our language exemplifying the ding-dong theory, and many others where sound represents an imitation, as in bow-wow or in the mooing sound of lowing cattle. The fact is that both theories are correct, and many others as well. What is important is to get hold of life as it really is, and if one does so, one will find that the bow-wow theory is more related to the vowels, and the ding-dong theory more to the consonants. But again, not entirely. Such a statement would also be one-sided, for eventually one will come to see that the consonants are formed as a kind of reflection of events or shapes in our environment, as I have indicated already in the little book titled The Spiritual Guidance of Man. Thus the letter F is formed in likeness of the fish, M in likeness of the mouth, or the letter L in the likeness of leaping, and so on. To a certain extent, the origin of the consonants could be explained by the ding-dong theory, only it would have to be worked out in finer detail. The vowels, on the other hand, are means of expressing and revealing the inner nature of a person. The forms of the letters expressing vowel sounds are not an imitation of outer things at all, but express human feelings of sympathy and antipathy. Thus feelings of joy or curiosity are expressed by the sound E, amazement or wonder by ah, as in father, I am astonished. A, in English, say, without the Y, expresses, I want to get rid of something that irritates me. Oo, as in shoot, I am frightened. I, as in kind, I am fond of you, I like you. Vowels directly reveal feelings of sympathy and antipathy. Far from being the result of imitation, they enable human beings to give utterance to their sympathies or antipathies. When hearing a dog's threatening bark, humans, if their feelings are akin to those of the dog, adapt their own experiences to the bow-wow sound of the dog, and so on. Vocalizing leads outwards from within, whereas forming consonants represents a movement inward from outside. Consonants reproduce outer things. Merely by making these sounds, one is already copying outer nature. You can confirm this by yourselves if you go into further detail. But since all this applies to sounds only, and not to words, you will be able to appreciate that when using the analytic method, one is actually progressing from the whole word to the original soul condition. In general, we must always try to recognize what the child at each stage is asking for inwardly. Then we shall proceed in freedom, just as a good photographer does when asking clients to look in many different directions in order to capture their personalities while taking their pictures, and thereby making such sessions so tedious. Similarly, a complete view is essential if one wants to get hold of the human being in depth. With the whole word method, one gains only the physical aspect. With the phonetic method, one is already approaching the region of the soul. And, however absurd this may sound, with the spelling method, one really enters the realm of the soul. Today this last method is, of course, looked upon as a form of idiocy, but without a doubt it is more closely related to the soul than the other methods. However, it must not be applied directly. It needs to be introduced with a certain pedagogical skill and artistry, which will avoid a too one-sided drill in pronouncing the letters in the conventional way. Instead, the child will gain some experience of how letters came about, and this is something which can live within its formative forces, something which is real for the child. This is the crux of the matter. And if young pupils have been taught along these lines, they will be able to read in due course, perhaps a few months after their 9th year. It does not really matter if they cannot read earlier, because they have learned it in a natural and wholesome way. Depending on the various children's response, this stage may be reached a little earlier or later. This 9th year marks the beginning of one of the smaller life cycles. The larger ones have already been spoken about several times. They are, from birth to the second dentition, from the second dentition to puberty, and from then on into the 20s. But these days, by the time young people have reached their 20s, one no longer dares speak to them of a further developmental phase, which will reach its climax after the age of 21. This would be considered a sheer insult. At that age, they feel fully mature. At that age, they already publish their own articles in newspapers or magazines. And so one has to exercise great discretion when speaking about life's later stages of development. But for the educator, it is important to know about the larger life periods, as well as about the smaller ones contained in them. Between the 9th and the 10th year, but nearer to the 9th, one of the smaller periods begins, when the child gradually awakens to the difference between self and the surrounding world. Only then does it become aware of being a separate ego. All teaching before this stage should therefore make the child feel at one with its surroundings. The most peculiar ideas have been expressed to explain this phenomenon. For example, you may have heard people say, quote, "When a young child hurts itself by running against a corner, it reacts by hitting the corner," close quote. An intellectual interpretation of this phenomenon would be that one hits back only if one has consciously received a hurt or an injury consciously inflicted. And this is how the child's response in hitting a table or other object is explained. This kind of definition always tempts one to quote the Greek example of a definition of the human being, namely, a human being is a living creature which has 2 legs, but no feathers. As far as definitions go, this is quite correct. It leads us back into the times of ancient Greece. I won't go into details to show that present definitions in physics often are not much better, for there, too, children are frequently taught that a human being is a creature that walks on 2 legs and has no feathers. A boy who was a bit brighter than the rest thought about this definition. He caught himself a cockerel, plucked out its feathers, and took it to school. He presented the plucked bird, saying, "This is a human being. It is a creature that walks on 2 legs and has no feathers." Well, definitions may have their uses, but they are almost always one-sided. The important thing is to find one's way into life as it really is, something I have to repeat time and again. The point is that before the 9th year, a child does not yet distinguish between self and surroundings. Therefore, one cannot say that a little child, when hitting the table that caused it pain, imagines the table to be a living thing. It would never occur to a child to think so. This so-called animism, the bestowal of a soul on an inanimate object, an idea which has already crept into our history of civilization, is something that simply does not exist. the fantastic theories of some of our erudite scholars who believe they have discovered that human beings endow inanimate objects with a soul are truly astonishing. Whole mythologies have been explained away in the light of this theory. It strikes one that people who broadcast such ideas have never met a primitive person. For instance, it would never occur to a simple peasant who has remained untouched by our sophisticated ways of life to endow natural phenomena with a soul quality. Concepts such as ensouling or animation of dead objects simply do not exist for the child. The child feels alive, and consequently everything around it must be alive also. But even such a primitive idea does not enter its dim and dreamy consciousness. This is the reason why in teaching of pupils under 9, you must not let the child's environment and all that it contains appear as something separate from the child. You must let plants come to life. Everything must live and speak to the child, because it does not yet make the distinction between its own self and the world at large. From this it will become evident that before the 9th year you cannot reach the child with any kind of intellectual descriptions. Everything has to be transformed into pictures, into fresh and living pictures. As soon as you pass on to a more direct description, you will achieve nothing during this 8th to 9th year. This approach becomes possible only later. One has to find one's way into each specific life period. Up to the 9th year, the child only has an understanding for a pictorial presentation. Everything else will bypass it, just as sound bypasses the eye, EYE. But between the 9th and 10th year, as the child gradually becomes more aware of its own identity, you can begin to present more factual descriptions of plants. However, it is not yet possible to describe anything belonging to the mineral kingdom, for the child's newly evolving capacity for differentiation between self and world is not yet strong enough to allow it to grasp the significant difference between what has life of its own and what belongs to the dead mineral world. At this stage, it can only appreciate the difference between its own self and the plant. Thereafter, you can gradually progress to a description of animals. But again, this has to be done in such a way that the introduction to the animal world remains something real for the child. Today there is an established form of botany, and with it goes the tendency to introduce this subject in junior schools just as it stands. This is done out of a kind of indolence, but it is really a dreadful thing to carry the botany of adults into the younger classes of our school. For what is this botany of ours really? It consists of a systematic classification of plants arranged according to certain agreed principles. First come the fungi, then algae, ranunculacea, and so on, one family put neatly next to the other. But if such a branch of science, which itself may be quite acceptable, is taught to young children in schools, it is almost as if one were arranging different kinds of hairs plucked out of a human body and classifying them systematically according to where they grew, behind the ears, on the head, on the legs, and so on. Following this method, you may manage to build up quite an impressive system, but it will not help you to understand the real nature of hair. And because it seems almost too obvious, one might easily neglect to relate the various types of hair to the human being as an entity. The plant world does not have its own separate existence either, for it is part of the earth. You may think that you know the laburnum from what you can find in a botany book about it. I have no objections to its botanical classification. But to understand why its blossoms are yellow, you have to see it standing on a sunny slope, and you have to include in your observation the various layers of earth out of which it grows. Only then will you realize that its color, yellow color, is connected with the colors of the earth from which it grows. But in this case, you look upon this plant as you would look at hair growing out of a human body. Earth and plants, as far as the child knows them already, remain one. You must not teach adult botany in junior classes, and this implies that you cannot describe a plant without at the same time also talking about the sun shining upon it, about climatic conditions, and about the configuration of the soil, of course, in a manner appropriate to the age of the child. To teach botany in the way this is done in object lessons, taking isolated plants one next to another, violates the nature of the child. Even in object lessons, everything depends on the choice of object to be studied. The child has an instinctive feeling for what is living and for what is truly real. If you come with something dead, you inflict wounds upon what is thus alive in the child. You attack its sense of truth and reality. But nowadays there is little awareness of the subtle differences in the qualities of things. Imagine contemporary philosophers pondering the concept of being, of existing. It would make precious little difference to them whether they chose a rock crystal or a blossom as the object of their contemplation, for both, quote-unquote, are. One can put them both on a table. Both are things that exist. But this is not at all the truth. With regard to their being, they are not homogeneous. The rock crystal you can pick up again after 3 years. It is by dint of its own existence. But the blossom is not at all as it appears. A blossom taken by itself is an untruth in nature. To ascribe existence or being to the blossom, one has to describe the entire plant. Taken by itself, it is an abstraction in the world of matter. Not so the rock crystal. But today one has lost the sense for such differentiations within the reality of things. The child, however, still has this feeling by instinct. If you bring something to the child that is not a whole, it experiences an uncanny feeling. Such a thing can follow it right into later life. Otherwise, Tagore would not have described the sinister impression the amputated leg made upon him in his childhood. A human leg in itself does not represent reality. It has nothing to do with reality. For a leg is only a leg as long as it is part of a whole organism. If cut off, it ceases to be a leg. Such things have to become flesh and blood again, so that by progressing from the whole to the parts, we grasp reality. It can all too easily happen that we treat a separate part completely wrongly, if we take it in isolation. And so in the case of botany and junior classes, we must start with the earth as a whole and look upon the plants as if they were hair growing out of it. And with regard to the animal world, a child cannot gain a proper relationship to the animal at all if you follow the usual method of classification. As animal study is introduced only in the 10th or 11th year, you can now expect a little more from the children. But to teach animal study, according to the usual classification, has little real meaning for pupils of that age, even if this method is scientifically justified. The reality is that the entire animal kingdom represents a spread-out human being. Take a lion, for example. There you see a one-sided development of the chest organization. Take the elephant. Here the entire organization is oriented toward a lengthening of the upper lip. In the case of the giraffe, the entire organization strives toward the lengthening of its neck. If you can thus see in each animal a one-sided development of a human organic system, and survey the entire animal kingdom down to the insect, one could go even further, right down to the geological animals. Terebras are not really geological animals anymore. Terebras, I don't know how to pronounce that. It's T-E-R-E-B-R-A-S. Then you will come to the realization. The entire animal kingdom is a human being, spread out like an opened fan. And the human physical organization comprises the entire animal kingdom folded together like a closed fan. This is how one can bring the mutual relationship between the human being and the animal into proper perspective. Putting all this into such few words is making it into an abstraction, of course. You will have to transform it into living substance until you are able to describe each animal form in terms of a one-sided development of a specific human organic system. If you can find the necessary strength to give your pupils a lively description of animals in this sense, you will soon see how they respond, for this is what they want to hear. And so the plants are linked to the earth, as if they were the hair of the head. The animal is linked to the human being, and seen as a one-sided development of various human organic systems. It is as if human arms or legs, and in other instances the human nose or trunk and so on, had grown into separate existences to live as animals on earth. This is how pupils can gain an understanding of the animal forms. It will enable the teacher to form his lessons so that their content is attuned to what is living in the growing human being, in the child itself. The end of Lecture 4.